one's called Naxalite. Brothers and sisters of the soul, you now we are one in the visible and strong. They may try to break us, but they don't underestimate us. They know our memories are longer. I said up as I sleep in villages. That's how they picture me, at least that's what they try to pretend. But check out our histories of witch and revolution. We are prophecy that we will rise again.
Welcome back. You're listening to a special New Year's edition of South Asian Community News, part of La Rage du Peuple, a look back at the resistance of local and global social justice movements, and a look ahead at the struggles to come in 2007. We were just listening to Asian Dub Foundation's Naxalite. Naxalite is a term referring to the social justice Maoists, I guess, the uprisings in India. It originated in a town called Naxalbari in West Bengal. And I hope we'll have Biplab Halim, who's going to speak to us from West Bengal about current struggles in West Bengal later in the show. But up next, we're going to hear a pre-recorded interview that I did with Aarti Shahani, an interview I did with her just a few days ago as part of La Rage du Peuple, as part of South Asian Community News, to get her thoughts on immigrant justice and racial justice organizing in the U.S. Aarti is an organizer with Families for Freedom in New York City. It's a multi-ethnic defense network by and for immigrants facing and fighting deportation, comprised of immigrant prisoners, former immigrant prisoners, their loved ones, or individuals at risk of deportation, mainly from Latin America, the Caribbean, and South Asia. Aarti, who herself has fought against the detention and deportation of her close family members, speaks in this interview about recent immigrant rights and racial justice mobilizations in the U.S. in 2006 and the challenges ahead in 2007, as well as the specific role of South Asian migrants in the struggle. So we're going to hear from Aarti Shahani. I'm talking with Aarti Shahani. Aarti is an organizer with Families for Freedom based in New York City. Aarti, welcome. Welcome to CKUT.
Thank you for having me.
Aarti, I guess an obvious place to start when assessing the past year is the incredible mobilizations around immigrant rights, around the issue of legalization, against various policies introduced at Congress in the U.S. And these protests were, I mean, just observing them from here were impressive in so many ways. The sheer numbers of people, we're talking about in some places hundreds of thousands of people that mobilized, not just once, but over the period of several months. And also the depth of the movement insofar as we're not just talking about major cities like Chicago, LA, New York, but also smaller centers. And I'm wondering that if you can assess for us then the significance of what happened in the past year.
Well, those are definitely the right adjectives. I would say as a relatively young organizer that it was mind-blowing and eye-opening to see the types of mobilizations, very spontaneous, that happened throughout the country, where you really saw regular people seizing the moment and really calling the shots in terms of the energy, how it was happening, when it was happening, where it was happening, of course, with some infrastructure in place to really amplify what people were saying. I think that 2006 will have a lot of significance for U.S. politics in terms of the largest mass mobilizations in nationals. And I think that the challenge becomes that these mass mobilizations that just swept the nation, what happens then to the immigrant rights movement and the racial justice movement in 2007? I think right now one key challenge that we're having is that, you know, against the backdrop of this popular movement, there is this agenda for immigration reform that some have called comprehensive immigration reform, is that in the United States, the immigration debate as it's playing out amongst lawmakers is very much about immigration as business interests. It's not about the human rights of immigrants. It's not about the rights of families to be together. It's not about community health or even assimilation. It's very much about what business wants and needs and how to accommodate that. And so I think that much of the conversation in D.C. is about how can we bring the laws, the immigration laws, on the side that it needs to be so that businesses aren't liable for the practices that they have going on. And plenty of sort of pro-immigrant lawmakers that want to see some legislation happen might end up, you know, really undercutting and underselling their bases and underselling immigrant constituents because they just want to see something happen. So to give a case in point, you know, Senator Kennedy has been really at the forefront of a lot of the comprehensive immigration reform movement in the U.S. And I think what's so important for his office to recognize, as well as others, is that when lawmakers started talking about comprehensive immigration reform, even back in 2005, they didn't yet have this massive upswelling. And then when they go back to the drawing board with the new Congress in place, they can't act as though this mass power, this mass mobilization never happened.
You've talked about the people who are sort of directly affected by these issues, and you've just talked about the leaders who can and might sell out what people are actually demanding on the streets. I'm wondering if you could talk about that a bit more, because looking at these protests, obviously there's a side to it which is very specific in terms of what it's demanding of Congress, what it's demanding of policymakers. But you're also hearing other things. For example, especially the protests in California, but elsewhere as well, that slogan, "We didn't cross the border crossed us," comes up. There's this assertion that there is the right to go across borders, that the whole idea of borders, particularly the Mexican-American border, is absurd. And so you have a no borders constituency, I guess you can call it, that's being asserted, particularly by youth. So I'm just wondering how you see that being navigated, how you see the more radical or the more fundamental position that the border itself, the idea of classifying certain migrants as legal is absurd, versus those who are portraying this in terms of policy. And I don't want to portray them as a contrast, but I just want to acknowledge that those two tendencies are there, and just interested in how you see that being navigated in the future.
On the policy level, which is by no means the end-all be-all, I mean, when we talk about policy, when we talk about laws, we're talking about just a piece of how humans experience life, you know? But on the policy level, I think that what you're seeing is a lot of battling over what are the terms of the debate and what are the real stakes, not just between those people who do and don't like immigrants, but within what we call the immigrant rights movement. I think that you're having a real generational gap in some ways. I think that you're seeing, you know, over the last 20 years since the 80s, you've seen a complete transformation of what it means to be an immigrant in this country, from the crossing of a border that's increasingly militarized to living in an interior that's increasingly militarized, where you feel yourself as a non-citizen left and right every day. Back in the 80s, when my parents were here and we were undocumented for a while, they could still get jobs, they could still amass capital, they could still rent an apartment, they still had ID. Now when you talk about the experience of an undocumented immigrant in New York or anywhere else in the country, you're talking about folks that don't have ID, that can't even go to the DMV and get a driver's license, that are afraid to go to schools and to hospitals, that can no longer even find, you know, crappy jobs. And so one thing that you're definitely seeing is a pushback from different, you know, local leaders, from youth, saying, listen, this is the experience that immigrants are going through, and part of the reality is that legalization won't solve all of this. You know, one thing that's very dangerous about just demanding legalization without understanding what full legalization means is that right now, granting green cards to some people still leaves a whole mess of other people without papers. We understand that giving people papers means that there are always going to be people without papers. Now, how we treat those people without papers is a whole separate question. It's something that my organization refers to as delegalization or deportation, you know? And so one of our concerns is that in 2007, we really catapulted into the national policy conversation, a conversation about how we treat migrants across the board, how we distinguish between citizens and non-citizens, and to stop policing people based on immigration status, regardless of what that status might be. But now, you know, on a second note, apart from the policy world of Washington, D.C., that's always a mess and increasingly and embarrassingly corrupt, on a local level, I think what you're really seeing is a lot of groups trying to push back and trying to push their cities and their state governments to stop acting like immigration enforcers. So in New York, for example, we are really pushing for New York City to stop collaborating with immigration. And that means at all levels, including through the criminal system. In New York, the primary way people get picked up for deportation is through our jails and our prisons. America is also well known as the global leader in incarceration. And what happens to non-citizens who are incarcerated is that they get picked up for deportation after serving a sentence, after never even knowing that could result in deportation. So what we're trying to do, to give an example, Rikers Island in New York is the largest jail country. And every week from Rikers Island, you have 300 immigrants picked up for deportation, the single biggest pipeline in the city into deportation. Now, a lot of the people picked up are youth who were interviewed and interrogated by immigration without any counsel present, without notification to families, without knowing who the people interrogating them were. A lot of these youth, often sent in the deportation process, get picked up and shuttled all over the country, over 250 facilities that house immigrant detainees. And then at the end of it all, without even having counsel represent them, because no free public defender is given in this process, they're kicked out of the country. Now, we want to stop that practice, but we don't have hope that the federal government's going to do it. We have hope that New York City might be a little bit enlightened, and our lawmakers here might be a little bit enlightened and stop the collaboration.
You referred earlier to not just an immigrant rights movement, but a racial justice movement. And this might be very obvious, but I'll still ask it. And why do you feel it's important to refer to both in the same breath, an immigrant rights movement, that it's also a racial justice movement?
I think it's foolish to think of the immigrant rights movement as outside issues of race and racial justice and racism, because frankly, the meaning of immigration status has changed throughout U.S. history. It used to be, when it was the Irish coming to this country, they were taken off the voting booth for the Democratic machine. They were given, you know, full voting rights as aliens. Now what you have is nothing even close to that. You can't even get a driver's license in this country. And I think that how much we're penalizing people based on their migration status in terms of subjecting them to prosecution for working, subjecting them to prosecution for trying to find documents, deporting them after minor crimes, things like that. A lot of the punishments we're putting on people based on migration status is because increasingly migrants are black and brown people. You know, increasingly you can't legislate between black and white on the books. You can't use those terms legally to do it, even though it happens, you know, de facto plenty. But distinguish between citizen and non-citizen. So increasingly non-citizen is code for race. And that's what we're seeing happen in the United States. I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that the demographics of immigration is pushing so much of the concern about policing immigrants. If it was a creamier colored population, maybe people wouldn't be going through the same type of thing. And I think the other reason the racial justice lens is so important is that for my people, people in my organization and even in my family, people that I know and love who've experienced deportation, which is the most dramatic punishment you can get as an immigrant, hit them just because they were immigrants. It was felt more of felony disenfranchisement. So, you know, for example, for my father, for my uncle, for people and families for freedom, people are picked up through jails and prisons. They're arrested by NYPD. And after all that has happened, after they've been processed through the criminal system, they're picked up for deportation. It's experienced as a second punishment. So often people think about deportation as double jeopardy, as something hitting them because of having some sort of past record. And I think that felony disenfranchisement is a very familiar story to many, and try to just revert to this idea of immigrants as these hard workers that have just come here looking for jobs without any contact with the institutions that are policing plenty of people here.
Your organization, Families for Freedom, is essentially made up of the family members and people who are facing deportation, who deal with the reality of detention. And I'm wondering if you can speak to how those directly affected voices, how are they being heard within this movement? Are they actually leading this movement? Are their voices respected, or is this a situation where those voices are marginalized despite the existence of groups like Families for Freedom and organizers like yourself and others?
I think poor people have always been marginalized, but it doesn't mean you can't try anyway, and you kind of have to try anyway. You know, something that we always tell people coming to us when we try to recruit them into the organization is, listen, no one's going to care about this struggle more than you because you're going through it. And so you have an obligation to get involved, you know, and that's our perspective on it. And I think that part of the effort is to amplify people's power as much as possible so that, you know, singly joining hands, coming together might actually make a demand for the organization. To give one example, one young man in our organization, a teenager named Julio, who witnessed his father being deported, his dad was taken away at dawn by a group of immigration officers. They came to their door, took the dad away to deport him to the Dominican Republic. Julio had testified at a town hall meeting with Congressman Jose Serrano from the Bronx. After his testimony, Congressman Serrano, who was moved by Julio's story and by all the other stories he hears in his office, went ahead and sponsored a bill called the Child Citizen Protection Act. It's going to be reintroduced in the next session. And the Child Citizen Protection Act basically is a bill that would create a pardon in deportation for people that have U.S. citizen children. Most Americans, possibly most Canadians, don't know that the U.S. immigration deportation system is a mandatory minimum system. When people get picked up for it, by and large, you're not eligible for release. The proceeding is a joke, and a judge orders you deported regardless of your ties to this country. So Serrano's bill is an effort to bring the laws in line with common sense and to create a pardon for American-born children to be heard before mom or dad is taken away. And I would say that Serrano would never have been moved to sponsor that bill if he didn't personally hear Julio's story and feel moved by it and understand, you know, with open eyes, wow, this is a problem that's actually fixable. And so I feel optimistic. You know, in the last few months, you've just seen so many stories all over the place. For example, Elvira Arellano in Chicago, who took sanctuary in the United Methodist Church and is a strong part of Centro Sin Fronteras, you know, she's been really motivating to people around the country that have been living in fear, not sure where they should go and afraid to walk the streets, because she, with the partnership of her religious leaders and her political leaders, said, you know what, immigration wants me to go, but I'm staying here. And why? Because I have an 8-year-old son named Saulito. He was born in this country, and we have a right to raise him over here. So I think that one thing that's been wonderful about 2006 is that, you know what, you actually are seeing regular people rise up and regular people get heard. And I think that while that those conditions are there, while that wave is there, more and more people have to ride it.
Artie, I guess it's fair to say that the majority of the people who are part of these mobilizations are Latino. That's a sort of a reflection of the demographics of who migrates to the U.S. I'm wondering if you could speak to the role of South Asians. I don't necessarily like that catch-all term, but I'll use it. South Asians, people from the subcontinent, within this immigrant rights and racial justice movement. South Asians are seen superficially, but are seen as model minorities within the U.S., and clearly you and your day-to-day organizing deal with a whole other reality of what that so-called model minority is going through. So can you speak a bit to the role of South Asians within this immigrant rights, immigrant justice, racial justice movement in the U.S.?
Yeah, on a few levels. One is, I think that the whole South Asian model minority thing has dissolved quite a bit with the war on terror, because increasingly the face of that war on terror looks a whole lot more like me and you, you know. And so I think that the once more comfortable stereotype is kind of starting to fall apart. Now, I don't actually think that's the worst thing in the world, because I think in terms of people's realities, lived realities, South Asians have a whole lot more in common with Latino workers, Latino immigrants, than they have in common with Middle America, whatever that's. I know during the mobilization I spoke to quite a few Indian newspapers and reporters asking, well, you know, this whole legalization, is it just going to benefit Mexicans? What about the Indians? What about Pakistanis? Things like that. And I recall thinking, you know, one thing that's so tricky about the immigration debate is that mainstream media really does try to, people of different nationalities really have to overcome that and recognize that the immigration debate here, what's seen as the domestic immigration debate, is really part of international politics, and an international politics where the U.S. economy consistently rears its head. So there's no reason, for example, for Indians to not think about the conversation with President and India's heads of state. You know, I think that Pakistan and Bangladesh need to do similar types of things. And part of, you know, what I'd mentioned very briefly before is that one of the things that we're doing on a much more local level is trying to get consulates and embassies to defend their nationals. Now, one thing I can definitely say for the South Asian consulates and embassies is to defending their nationals in U.S. immigration systems. And I think, you know what, for all that you complain about a system that's just favoring Latinos, how much are you actually doing to step up to the plate and hit hard for your own people? And I think that that type of, you know, backstepping needs to be called out. People in power love to pretend that they have no power, including the governments that are claiming that, you know, somehow the system is only going to benefit one nation rather than another.
Are there particular challenges organizing within the South Asian community of South Asian migrants who face deportation, who are facing detention?
I mean, right off the bat, it's very well known that in the South Asian community you have so many different languages and so multi-ethnic or to do. I think the other thing is leadership. I think across communities, we don't need our leaders to constantly talk on our behalves and sort of flash business cards and nice ties in front of the mayor's office. I think what we need is more people in the grind and more people willing to get their hands dirty and get regular people involved. And so I'd say across communities in New York, certainly, you know, we don't have enough leadership like that, leadership that has a lot of dirt under their nails. And so I think that that's going to be more of a challenge. And I think that, again, maybe it's generational or maybe it's New York, but I think that we'll have to try to overcome that in 2007. Because you have a situation now where you have, you know, regular people with an amazing amount of untapped potential anger and energy asking, what can I do, what can I do, what can I do? And then the job of leadership is to answer what you can do in a way that's meaningful and that actually respects people's power.
Artie, I spoke to another immigrant rights organizer based in California, and he's older than both of us, and he talked about how the mobilizations that emerged in 2006 were 10 years in the making. From your perspective, I know you've been organizing for a few years. Where do you see the origins of what sort of exploded in 2006? Was it because the bill that was proposed in the House of Representatives and passed was so extreme? Was this something that was a long time in the making? Was it a surprise? Can you just talk to the origins of this movement? Because no movement just comes from nowhere.
Sure. The most provocative and I think interesting take I heard on the mobilizations came from Francis Kopitora, a very interesting organizer who does work on remittances in the Global South. Francis had explained in his point of view that possibly these mobilizations and the energy for them really came from Latin American politics. You look at all of the mass mobilization and energy that's been sweeping Venezuela, Bolivia, Brazil, throughout the Southern Hemisphere. The fact is, the migrants here have deep connections to politics back home. A lot of the immigrants in the U.S. are leaders of political parties back home, very politically involved, very politically savvy. And I think that a lot of the energy that hit the U.S. is really an extension of Latin American politics. I think that that's also a very good thing. And I think that part of the reason that Congress backed down from passing a bad immigration law, which it really wanted to do, was fearing, you know, these mobilizations could turn into something more. And they've been seeing the politics of the hemisphere, and they're really afraid of it. But I would say that it's definitely been a long time in the making. And I think that besides the fact that it's been a long time in the making across time, I'd also say that across space, we're clearly seeing U.S. domestic politics as an extension of the hemisphere.
So, Arti, looking ahead to 2007, how do you assess the organizing challenges in the upcoming year for groups like Families for Freedom as you build on the past year of mobilizing? And I ask that in the context of this wall that's being built. That was one tangible reaction by the government, which was to pass this bill that's going to increase border enforcement and continue to build the wall. What are the challenges that are faced as we look forward to 2007 and beyond?
I think our greatest challenge is to not miss the opportunities we actually have. So I really hope that in 2007, as a nationwide immigrant rights movement, people are smart enough to not undermine the power that immigrants have actually flexed in 2006, to build upon it and to articulate a pro-immigrant agenda that includes legalization and that also includes an end to illegal deportation, to militarizing the border, to the things that will actually make us safe, to repealing employer sanctions, things like that. Now, in terms of the border bill, I think one key thing is that, you know, laws won't matter if you don't get the money for them, so I deeply hope that it's not appropriated, you know, that we don't actually secure the money to go ahead and build even more than has already been built along the border, as well as more detention facilities in the interior, which was another thing that passed in 2006. I'd say for my organization, there are a couple of very concrete goals we have. One is to see legislation in Congress that deals with deportation. Deportation is a very specific part of the immigrant experience and the immigration agenda. We want to see a bill that values American-born children and recognizes that when we talk about immigration, we're also talking about American community, and we want to see Congress recognize that and repeal some of the terrible laws that passed in 1996 along with welfare reform. I'd say the other thing that we want to do is we actually want to push other governments to step up, because immigration really does take two to tango, and a lot of the governments that complain about deportees, that complain about U.S. immigration policy, have to now prioritize working in coalition to respond on a regional level, because if they don't do that, they're major power players that are missing from the equation.
Thanks for speaking with us at CKUT.
Thank you.